We'll call the Senate Tax Committee to order for March 25th, 2015. Senator Eakin, Western Border Cities Enterprise Zones. Welcome to the Tax Committee, Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 907 deals with the Minnesota Border Cities. And there are handouts in your packet. You can see where those cities are located, all on the western border. East Grand Forks, Moorhead, Dilworth, Breckenridge, and Ortonville. This is funding for a program that was put into place in the 1980s. There was a recognition at that time that there were unique situations faced by those cities on the western border. And the unique situation was the disparity between North Dakota and Minnesota, and the disadvantage that many of our western cities were put in because of those disparities. Those disparities have only grown more severe over time. As everyone knows, the oil boom in North Dakota has really made North Dakota an outlier as far as other states in terms of the amount of wealth being generated in that state. And that has translated into, again, greater disparities between North Dakota and Minnesota. And there's a real need to level the playing field. Again, that was recognized back in the 1980s. That need has only grown. The Minnesota Borders program has been working very well. But one of the issues has been the issue of stability. And so we are requesting in this bill permanent funding that would allocate $1 million and be ongoing in order to achieve that stability so that there's predictability and sustainability in the program. As everyone knows, businesses, when they're looking at places to locate or where to do business, they're not just looking at 1 year, they're looking at the long term. And so that stability is critically important for that reason, in order to attract and retain businesses and job opportunities here in Minnesota. The payback is significant for Minnesota. The money that's invested in this program will be more than made up for because of the additional tax revenue that's being generated because there's more businesses and more jobs here in Minnesota. It'll be paid back many times over. And it addresses the many disparities that that I've already referred to. And I do have with me today the Deputy City Manager for the City of Moorhead, Scott Hutchins, who would also like to testify to the bill.
Welcome, Mr. Hutchins.
Good morning,
State your
Mr.
name
Chair.
For the tape and let the record reflect we have a quorum.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Scott Hutchins, City of Moorhead. Thank you very much. First of all, thank you very much for the assistance that's been provided over the years to Minnesota border cities. It has certainly been very critical in stemming the tide of business outflow out of our communities to North Dakota, and been very critical in retaining our business and job base and employee base in our communities. The communities in your packet, it's noted that that the communities, the border cities, use the assistance in a variety of ways. For instance, in East Grand Forks, they have used the assistance to attract new development and new business to the city of East Grand Forks. And if the city administrator of East Grand Forks were here, he would tell you that with a repurposing and repositioning of the Grand Forks Air Force Base to working with drones, there's a great opportunity, they believe, for East Grand Forks to compete with Grand Forks in capturing some of the business spinoff that will come from that repurposing of the air base. The city of Dilworth, adjacent to the city of Moorhead, working with the state of Minnesota, was able to convert a vacant Kmart facility into a pharmaceutical testing lab, a tremendous project for the city of Moorhead. Border city credits were used and very instrumental in achieving that successful economic development project for the city of Dilworth. In Moorhead, the credits have been used both for job retention and for economic development in the sense of attracting new business and industry. And so, therefore, it's critical in our overall economic development approach. The city provides credits to offset some of the workers' compensation costs that are different for businesses on the border compared to their neighbors in North Dakota. And that secures, that business retention effort secures 3,000 jobs in the city of Moorhead that are retained through this contribution of border city credits. As Senator Eakin notes, there are still competitive issues, and your handout highlights some of those competitive areas in terms of tax base, the lower percentage of commercial industrial tax base in the border communities vis-a-vis their neighbors in North Dakota, taxable sales, per capita wealth, and other measures that we think are important and indicate the need for this continuing support and sustainable support that Senator Eakin is, has noted. With the advent of North Dakota oil at this time, albeit oil prices have taken a dip and therefore some of the state revenues in North Dakota have taken a dip commensurately, there is no indication that the oil boom is going away anytime soon in western North Dakota. And it will continue to put stress on the western Minnesota border cities. And therefore, once again, this type of continued and sustained support is really critical at this particular time for our communities. And I appreciate the opportunity, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hutchins. And members, this is very similar to provisions we had last year in the tax bill. Any questions, members? Senator Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Eakin, what kind of taxes then in particular would that $1 million be able to be used for? I see some designations, but I don't know exactly what they mean. So what are the options that they can be used for?
Senator Eakin.
Mr. Chair and Senator Gazalka, property taxes is one of those, and also credits for the number of employees that are hired by the businesses that are receiving the aid and assistance from this program. And Mr. Hutchins can also give more details on that.
Mr. Hutchins.
Mr. Chair and members, that's exactly right. The credits are primarily used for job credits. For both the program that I mentioned in my remarks, providing some offset on workers' compensation costs, which is a particularly a competitive issue when you're right adjacent to the same type of employer across the river in our case. Yeah. So it goes there, as well as to attract new business and industry. And that's primarily in the form of a per-employee job credit. And statute sets the limits of what those credits can be.
Okay. Thank you.
And Senator Gazalka, they do have some flexibility. I think they could also use them for sales tax if they wanted to, but I don't think they have done that.
All right. Thank you.
Senator Sanjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Eakin, or your witness, I'm thinking about the workers' comp. So we would allocate this $1 million, and it would go to, I think, the city of the respective cities, and then how would the cities take that same money and apply it towards workers' comp costs? Is that on a proportional basis or something like that to the business?
It's used to reduce what is paid in workers' compensation, and that's fluctuated based on the amount of money that's been in the border cities legislation, but Mr. Hutchins can give more details again on exactly how it works.
Thank you. Mr. Hutchins.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sanjum, the City of Moorhead works closely with DEED and the Department of Revenue that has an established process where forms are transmitted in exchange between an applying business, a business applying to the city to receive a particular level of credit based upon their audited premiums. And there's an exchange of documents between revenue and the city and the business. And the vehicle for providing them that incentives is through the corporate tax of the business, and the credit is received vis-a-vis the tax, and it is a program that has been in place for many years, funded through the Border City program. And what it does is offset, in your materials it describes, in fact shows, a few businesses that are in Moorhead, and the degree of a difference in workers' compensation costs that they experience with what would be the cost in North Dakota. And primarily, the reason is not necessarily all the time that rates are particularly different between the two states, although they are on occasion, but that North Dakota applies those rates to a far lesser portion of salary. Now, it was also noted that the commensurate benefits that workers receive, there's all of those things that go into that equation. But in any event, as a competitive issue on the border, when you have like businesses that have one, it is another competitive disadvantage, and one that we've been successful, and I believe our local businesses certainly appreciate those that participate. We have a couple hundred businesses, more or less, that participate. Receiving that credit and recognizing that it's important, it's an important recognition of their benefit the value that we hold on their staying in Moorhead and in Minnesota, and it provides just a little bit of a relief to a competitive issue.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anyone else wish to testify on Senate File 907? Anything else, members? Members, last year this was a little bit smaller. It was $750,000, and it also is evidenced by their being here today was not made permanent. So those will be things we'll take a look at.
Mr. Chair, can I just add?
Senator Sengen.
Mr. Chair and Senator Egan, is this something heretofore we've kind of granted on a biennial basis? Or?
And Mr. Chair and Senator Sengen, that is correct. Okay. And that has been problematic because it's really been up and down, and again, that stability is very important and critical for businesses that are making long-term decisions as to where to locate and do their business. So.
Okay. Yeah, Senator Sengen, I guess we last did it in 2013.
Okay.
Seeing nothing else, anything else, Senator Egan?
No.
Okay. We'll lay this over for possible inclusion. Thank you very much. Chair lays Senate File 907 over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Saxog.
Thank you.
Senator Saxog, and looks like there's an A2 author's amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members. Today I'm presenting Senate File 1479, and we have the A2 amendment I'd like to have offered, and maybe Mr. Silva could explain a little bit.
Senator, this is the first stop for this bill.
It is.
Senator Coonan offers the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The A2 is adopted. Is the bill in the shape you'd like, Senator Saxog?
It is. And as I said, Mr. Chair, maybe Mr. Silva could help us out explaining the amendment as it is.
Mr. Silva, could you walk us through what exactly we've got going on here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Saxog and members. What the amendment is doing is accomplishing two things. The underlying bill is reducing the state general levy amounts, and what the amendment is doing is simply updating the reduction of the amounts based on the February forecast. And this first part of the amendment is adding back the value that is being essentially reduced from the seasonal rec tax capacity for purpose of the state levy and is putting that back onto referendum market value. Currently, the seasonal rec properties are not subject to the referendum market value. And what this is doing is phasing in the value in essentially a uniform way that's being reduced from the state levy and putting it back onto referendum market value for purposes of the local school levy.
And so, members, my understanding is that there would now be a separate statewide levy for seasonal rec, independent from the current statewide business tax, and it would have a tiered effect where when this fully is implemented, the values under $300,000 would be assessed into the local taxing jurisdiction, and anything over $300,000 would be assessed back to the state. I think that's my understanding of this. And that split, while we don't know exactly what it is, it's roughly 50-50, but we'll get more information on that, hopefully. Senator Saxog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with me today is Sam Walseth, representing the Minnesota Rural Education Association. He's going to give a brief presentation and help answer any questions
Mr. Walseth.
The committee might have.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Sam Walseth, Director of Legislative Action for the Minnesota Rural Education Association. We're a voluntary organization of about 200 school districts across greater Minnesota, including many in northern Minnesota, the north central lakes country. This has been an issue our members have been grappling with for many years, since the 2001 legislature decided to remove seasonal property from referendum market value. The dilemma faced by many of these districts, Cass Lake, Pine River Bacchus, Pelican Rapids, and others, is that they remain some of the highest valued referendum market value districts in the state, yet there's no direct correlation with their local property value and actually the actual wealth of the families and the students in those districts. These districts, we see their referendum market value, anywhere 60% higher than average compared to the rest of the state, yet their median household income is below 16% below on average for many of these seasonal districts, below the state median average of a household income of $44,000. So we don't see the correlation between the wealth of the district in terms of the property wealth and the wealth of the families there. And many of these students, the student body, the free and reduced population for many of the student body in those districts is very high. Numbers comparable to more of the urban core than what we'd expect for the rest of greater Minnesota. And so what this bill does is begins a transfer process of moving that seasonal recreational property back into referendum market value tax base, which will have the impact of reducing some of the referendum market value taxes on the homeowners and businesses in those towns and reducing their burdens as the state shares that local value back with these between the state and with those local jurisdictions. And we think this is a prudent process to help create some equity and fairness for these districts, and appreciate your support. Thank you, members.
Mr. Chair. Senator Rest.
Thank you very much. You know, part of that reform in 2001 in terms of removing the seasonal rec and business CI property from the referendum was in response to a number of, in particular, cabin owners who, and I have the most cabin owners in the state in my district. And when we had a meeting on it, there were over 500 people there, which is very unusual in a suburb. And it was always taxation without representation. They wanted to be able to vote in those school referendums because they were being asked to pay for them. So that reform got them off of that. And now, you know, 13, 14 years later, you're saying, well, it's harming the school districts. What I want to know is, will the thousands of cabin owners in my district expect me to support this change?
Senator Saxog?
Or are they going to be opposed to it?
Well, Senator Rest, I think we'll get the fiscal note, but it looks like there's $60 million impact to the state general levy. My expectation is that that would result in a tax reduction for them. We don't know what the impact on any individual cabin would be until we could assess
I'm asking generally to the class. Will seasonal rec owners see a decrease in their taxes, or will it just be a decrease in homeowners? That's what I'm reading here, and I'm just adding seasonal recreational property to the referendum tax base would lower the referendum rate. This would result in a decrease in net taxes for homesteads, which would decrease property tax refunds. We understand that. But I'm trying to see where it results in lower taxes for seasonal recreational properties.
I don't know that we have the Senator Rest. I don't know that we have the statewide average, because it depends upon the levy in the school district that the cabin is located in.
Mr. Chairman, I understand that, but I'm trying to get a general picture of whether cabin owners who own seasonal rec property, whether it's still a $60,000 small cabin, a shack on the lake, quite frankly, or whether it's a million-dollar property that's probably not owned by one of my constituents. I need to get comfortable with this proposal, Senator Saxog, and I need some more information. I'm not unsympathetic to separating these out, but I'm concerned that referenda will then be passed and the local officials will say, don't worry, you don't have to pay for it. The seasonal rec owners will pay for it. So just have to say that, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rust, we really do not know because it depends upon the what the individual levies are for the jurisdiction. I think we can see if we can try to get some more information for you there, but we just don't know it today.
I need to get more comfortable with this proposal, Mr. Chairman.
And Senator Rust, I think we don't want to speak for Senator Saxog, but I think part of the initiative here is as we are contemplating changes to this statewide business tax as a whole, being that this is part of that, we need to contemplate changes to this part of that also.
I understand that, Mr. Chairman. And a decrease of the statewide business tax, or whatever we call it, statewide levy on CI and seasonal rec, I support that. I have a bill on it, but I separating the seasonal rec back into property tax levies over which they have no voice concerns me.
Duly noted.
Okay.
Anything else, members? Mr. Forrester?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Forrester, and I'm executive director of Minnesota Lakes and Rivers Advocates. And we received this last night, and while we support modifications to the state general tax, we do not fully understand the impacts at this time. We've long been confused by the inclusion of cabin properties on a state business tax. We can't raise revenues to pay the tax. It's substantial, I guess $43 million last year. I'll defer to Senator Rust. She kind of took the words out of my mouth. We're, open to working on changes to the state general tax, but I don't understand the impacts to seasonal rec at this point. So I would want to see the same funds, I guess.
Well, the only thing I would say is, and I wasn't part of the conversation that put seasonal rec into the statewide business property tax. There have been a number of initiatives through the years, I've carried some of them myself, to try to undo some of that. And my rationale has always been that school districts have their value that's within their jurisdiction, and they should be able to tax that value for the operation of their school. Some school districts have skyscrapers in downtown Minneapolis, and some have lakes. But that's the value within their jurisdiction. And so that's what they have. And it makes it hard for schools that are located in those areas with a high concentration of lakes and cabins to operate and have an operating or having referendums when part of their value is excluded from their ability to raise those funds to operate their school. Senator Rust.
And Mr. Chairman, that was precisely the reason why the seasonal rec and regular CI were put together, because in the recreational areas of the state, the seasonal rec is their CI, so it's equivalent. In my district, I don't think I have any cabin owners that have cabins in the district. They're CI. In Senator Saxog's district, they're seasonal rec, so they were treated alike. And removed from the referendum and put on the statewide general levy, and then the purpose of it was to and this is where it went awry, I think, and why we have these things coming back up. It was dedicated for 1 year, and it was supposed to stay there. To the funding education. It was dedicated to it.
Yep.
And then the next year we start going in the hole again, and that money was grabbed into the general fund, and the education, our K-12 schools, did not get the benefit from it. In fact, they got harmed. And so I can understand that these proposals are coming to rectify that, but the same arguments that set the seasonal rec and the business property aside operates still. They're having to pay when they're not represented. And a bill that put the business property, CI property, and the and seasonal rec back on referendum? Now, that's fair. That's fair to my district and to your district. Now, it might not be very popular, but it, for the same reason, it's taxation without a voice, and other than the public, the bully pulpit. But to say it's okay for one to go back on the referendum market value and not the other, again, I have some serious problems with that. And I don't know what the solution is, and I want your school districts to be successful.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Rest, a couple things. There are examples of taxation without representation all across the state, so this would just be another one of those examples.
But these are subject to votes, Mr. Chairman, and some of the others are not.
But businesses, if you are an owner that lives in the cities and has a business in some other jurisdiction, you don't vote in that jurisdiction. That's an issue. But the part of your argument that has changed so dramatically is when this was instituted, the referendum was an excess levy, kind of for excess things that the school district wanted to do. Maybe they wanted to invest in some additional computers. Maybe they wanted to do a special class size reduction, something extra over and above the operations of the school. That has changed so that these are now the base operational levies of the school district. And that's the major change that has occurred, in that if you are in a school district that can't do one of these, you are at a disadvantage. Now, we made major improvements in that in the last 2 years with the school board approved levies. So that's helpful, but it still does leave the properties in that taxing jurisdiction outside of the levy. And if we're going to make changes to the statewide business tax, which we have a number of bills of which you are an author, this has to be part of the conversation. And what the end result is, we don't know, but the compromise that was made in 2000 was a class rate reduction and then inclusion into the statewide business property tax. So if we're starting to contemplate this, all of those things are going to bubble up and become part of our conversation as we move toward the end, I would imagine.
Mr. Chairman, I would agree, which is why I would say I have these questions, because, and you know this, and we all know this, if I don't advocate for my constituents, who will? I don't expect Senator Gazelka to care about my cabin owners as much as I do. You know,
I do care.
Right, no, but not as much. And so I have to see how they fit in to this wider picture as we look at these reductions in the statewide business tax. You know, where's that money coming from? Just from the surplus? It's ongoing, et cetera. We just need to be very careful about major changes.
Mr. Chair.
Absolutely. Senator Gazelka.
Senator Rest, I actually do care, but Senator Kuhn and I were talking about it's what we do for ag, it's what we do for business, it's what we do for seasonal rec. I mean, all of those are pieces that we have to figure out here, and I think you're right. At some level, they all have to be treated the same. My hope is at the end of the day that none of them end up paying more, that we figure out a way for that not to happen for all of those.
Don't let it be said that we don't have debate in the tax committee.
Because it's because I'm right and you're wrong.
To be determined. Senator Saxon.
And you know, just for purposes of light discussion here, the difference between a cabin and a summer home, and where you retire, and things like that. And I think even over the last 10 years, that's changed. And it really has increased the value. So,
and a lot of these could be in home non-resident homestead, right, where they would be part of the school levy as opposed to seasonal rec, which is removed.
Exactly. Yeah. You're right.
Anything else, members? Anyone else?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
I just need to. I stand corrected. It's only ag lands. Are we surprised? And cabins that don't pay the referendum. The business property does.
Anyone else wish to join our conversation on Senate File 1479? Seeing none, thank you, Senator Saxog. Thank you, testifiers. Chair will lay Senate File number 1479 as amended over for possible inclusion. We will look for further information with regard to the impact on the individual taxpayers. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Senator Jensen. Well, we're all warmed up, Senator Jensen.
Yeah, I noticed that. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate File 586. Some people come up here. This bill also deals with the statewide property tax levy, and there are several on your agenda today, so we'll have lots of conversation about where it came from. I was not in the legislature when the levy was put into place, but I do understand that it was enacted during the 2001 legislative session, and it was the first state property levy since 1967. The tax is only on certain properties, and it was enacted as part of a property tax reform law, and you had a little bit of discussion about it now, and it was directly linked to education. I understand that. And I also understand that the work that was being done was try to tackle rising property taxes, and that was an effort. And I do commend this committee, since I've been in the legislature, your work on tax reform. It has been fun to watch, and to participate today is a great honor for me to do. When we look at this particular tax, it started out at $588 million, and because of the inflationary factor that was included in the language, it's gone up to $840 million. So what this bill is asking, what I'm asking the committee to consider, is let's set it at the $840 million and then remove the inflationary language so that the businesses and the seasonal, all of them, do not have to deal with or worry about what the inflationary factor will do to them and to their business and to their ability to compete in the environment that they're in currently with a lot of other things going on. I'm not an economist. I'm not a tax expert, but I am a business owner. And I worked very closely with the business community in my community as chair of the policy committee at the chamber. And the conversations that I had in those years and the conversations that I've had since being elected lead me to believe that this is probably the most minimal step we can take on this tax levy. I think there are a lot of other suggestions that are out there that you can look at as well. So I consider this the most minimum. Let's just remove that inflationary factor. I think there are some things that should not be put on automatic, like this one has been, and that those economic factors should be looked at periodically to see how they are impacting, what are we getting from it, how is it working. So those are the things that I'm asking for in this bill. I do have some people here that would also like to speak to the issue.
Mr. Boer?
Yeah, I'm Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Gene Boer, president of First United Bank in Faribault, Minnesota. And I would like to just basically touch upon the impact that property taxes have had on businesses that I've worked with and also businesses that I'm aware of. I think we tend to lose track of the effect that we have on small businesses. We make an assumption that if a person owns a large property in their business, that they are also making lots of money and have the ability to pay higher taxes. I have a couple examples I just wanted to lay out. I was working with a restaurant that went out of business in 2012. Property taxes, they sold chicken. The property taxes on that particular facility were $45,000 a year. So I'd like you to imagine how many pieces of chicken you need to sell to make just the tax payment. I'm not saying the property taxes itself, was the lone factor for the failure of this business, but it was a huge impact on that. I have another restaurant that I've dealt with that was paying $27,000 a year in 2012, and the same thing. We own a building. The bank owns a building right next door that's a three-unit office building. We built it in 2006. Talk about great timing. Finally got it rented to the state. They've rented two-thirds of it. I still have one unit vacant. I'm presently, our rent we get is about $103,000 a year. I'm presently paying, well, last year it was $27,000. The taxes went up to $33,000 this year when my revenue is $104,000. So I think the thing that we need to really put in perspective is if we want people to take a chance in this state, they got to be comfortable with the tax levels that they're at, and 'cause it's really hard to plan when you have increases and the gyrations that we see on the property taxes as they go. And to keep in mind that the people that necessarily, in our case with our building, we had the resources to support it. But, you have a lot of people that are probably not even considered middle class that are trying to start businesses that are subject to huge tax bills, and that is basically the difference between success and failure. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bill.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Gazalka.
Thank you. To test for one brief question, the value of that building was approximately how much?
Which building are you referring to?
The one that the bank had.
Mr.
Well,
Brewer.
The cost that we had in it was $1.2 million. The assessed value, I think, was $800,000.
Senator Gazalka.
So, Mr. Chair, if they bought it for $1.2 million, say somebody bought it for $1.2 million and they put 20% down and had to finance $1 million, you talk about that $100,000 of rents, but your payment would be probably greater than that, and you pay $27,000 of taxes. So you're not making any money. You as a bank, you hold it, and so you didn't have that big investment. But the average person is not paying $1.2 million. They're borrowing and getting into the building. So if they don't have it fully rented with those kind of taxes, there's no way they make money. They lose money.
Exactly.
Ms. Libby.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members of the committee, and thank you, Senator Jensen, for bringing this forward. My name is Jennifer Libby. I'm the President and CEO of the Owatonna Area Chamber of Commerce and Tourism, and I'm humbled today to be here representing our membership and our businesses. Prior to this role, I spent 22 years in the private sector in the corporate community. I think one of the things, and I'm certainly not here to preach to the choir, but the exciting thing about this is that we're looking at something that gives us an opportunity to do something that's good for business. And I know we've all seen the statistics about where we rate in terms of taxes for business and different things, but to Senator Jensen's point, this is something small that we can do to remain competitive. From an economic development perspective, we talk a lot and often about 80% of our economic development growth coming from our existing businesses. And I particularly enjoy some of the examples that we've talked about earlier and the recognition of the small business perspective. I think we also need to keep in mind the larger business perspective. And prior to coming up here this morning, I spoke with a number of my members. One of the organizations has $200 million in revenue, employs over 325 people, is international, exports about a third of their product. And the senior VP simply said to me, they're just too high. So anything that we can do to keep that in Owatonna, to keep that in Minnesota, and to remain competitive is appreciated. Another individual, Joe Efforts, the president of Black Forest Limited, they're a recognition company, and he said, it's simple. The more we pay in taxes, the less we can reinvest in our business, the less we can grow. And I think it's really important that we remain cognizant of the fact that we've got businesses that want to grow. We've got businesses that want to increase not only their tax base, but their employee base, which results obviously in even more taxes with that. Again, simply stated, the high cost of taxes impedes this growth. We've got several manufacturers with plants in other states, and it makes it really easy if we give them one more reason to maybe expand there, and unfortunately we've had some of those examples recently, versus expanding within Minnesota. I think business property taxes is one of our greatest issues from a business community perspective, and I think that we've got a culture in Minnesota that we're a great place to we've got a great workforce. I think we continue to work on that culture of being business friendly, and this is a great step toward doing so with that. Economic development, again, retention and recruitment, clearly key. And if there's anything we can do to lower the burden on the businesses that are creating jobs and retaining jobs, frankly, it's good for the entire state. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for traveling this morning. We appreciate the information. Anything, questions, members?
I do.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When I was looking over the various bills dealing with the statewide property tax that are lowering it, including mine, I see different numbers that are used for the establishing the levy for 2016. And I wonder, either now or I don't understand why. I mean, I can't figure it out by looking there. And there's probably a simple explanation that I just don't get, but I wonder if Mr. Sylvia would explain, and we can do it now or do it after all of them have been presented, what makes the difference in the year? I look at it and I say, well, why is mine different than Senator Jensen's or the others? Can you help us out there?
Mr. Sylvia.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, for purposes of Senator Jensen's bill, the base amount for 2016 thereafter is locked in at what was the pay 15 amount, whereas your bill, you have the reduction over 4 years, but you reduce what would be the pay 16 amount by the 1.25% to arrive at the 5% reduction over 4 years.
For 2016, right? So what about the other one? What happens there?
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest,
Senator Thompson's bill.
Senator Thompson's bill is a phase out of the state levy completely over 6 years, and I'm not sure what the amount of reduction in the first year.
90%.
It's a 90% reduction in the first year, so that is the level.
10%.
Excuse me. 10% in the first year from pay. From pay 16.
So, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Sylvia, the three bills reach a different level for 2016 because we do something in our bills to change that number relative to the 2015 amount, which is identical in all bills, right?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, correct. Senator Jensen locks in the pay 15 amount, and your bill, Senator Rest, and Senator Thompson's bill reduces what would be the pay 16 amount by a corresponding amount, either a 10% reduction or, in your case, Senator Rest, to accomplish a 5% reduction over 4 years.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That helps a lot.
Anything else, members? Senator Sandin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a kind of a general question. I wouldn't expect the author to have this answer, but I've always kind of thought that, you know, the statewide general property tax, property taxes in general, I have felt should be at the on the table of local units of government. That's their land landscape in terms of which to tax, and the state ought to stay out of it. But just just generally, do we know 854,000? Do we know if that's the numerator? What is the denominator in terms of what percent of all property taxes in Minnesota is this 854? Is it 1%? Is it 10%? 20? Anybody have any idea? We don't need it today.
Senator Senjam, I think we'll have that answer before
okay.
the end of the meeting.
Thank you.
Senator Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Senjam, in concept, I agree, as long as we don't add back that additional statewide business property tax. You know, if that's totally gone, then let's have that discussion.
Right.
But, you know, to have both, I just think, is inappropriate when our business property taxes are already high compared to other
right.
states.
Yeah.
Mr.
So.
Chair.
Well,
I agree.
And we need to go back and revisit how this came about, because this was part of that
2001 reform.
2001 compromise, and they were struggling with how to do rate compression, because that was a big issue with regard to the business community, as the class rate was Senator Rest 3.
It's a trade-off, yeah.
It was the trade-off was to get the rate compression, and hence
sometimes people do bad deals.
But it doesn't mean we shouldn't revisit it this year.
Mr. Chair, I think Senator Rest was here, so maybe it was her fault.
That's why I've been blaming Senator Gazelle.
And Mr. Chair.
Senator Jensen.
From my perspective, there was a reduction in the class rate, and that's understood by the business community. It's just with the inflationary factor, is it getting back to, are we getting catching up to what actually was the benefit during that time? And that's one of the reasons I think we should remove the inflationary factor.
The only thing that we would want to think about, and the problem here is because as value would have gone up in a normal situation, the levy might have changed, and the levy isn't changing here. But if you were to look just strictly at the value increases that CI has had that is being impacted by the statewide business property tax, it would be significantly higher increases
right.
than what this inflator adjustment is. So, I mean, this is something that we're going to take a little study at as we go through the session. Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, too, with regard to the inflator, that has been a bone of contention from the very beginning, regardless of whether it went directly to education or got grabbed up by the general fund. And the arguments have been, decide what you need, in a sense, mm-hmm. and put a number in, rather than have the automatic inflation number, because it's easier to come up with debate on an actual number rather than debate the inflation factor. Now, the one that's used is a more conservative one, but nevertheless, it's hard to debate inflation as opposed to should the number be 850 million, or should it be 860 or 840 in any given year over the last 13 years? And the pro-inflator group has, which I have not necessarily supported, has always won out, and because they don't want to tackle, in my mind, they didn't want to tackle the issue of what's the appropriate amount if we're going to have this general levy. But I also share Senator Gazelka's concerns that as we get rid of or dramatically reduce or even modestly reduce the statewide general levy, that it's not offered as an opportunity for local governments to increase their levies and saying, well, don't worry about it. You're not really going to be paying more. Well, that's not right. That's not acceptable either.
Thank you, Senator, for those comments.
Senator Jensen.
I appreciate the comments.
Anything else, members? Anyone else wish to testify on Senate File 586? Thank you, Senator Jensen. Thank you for traveling this morning. Chair will lay Senate File 586 over for possible inclusion. Senator Rest.
Thank you.
Senator Rest, another approach.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And what my bill does is also an attempt, and it remains, at least in the first couple of years, a fairly modest attempt as well to deal with this issue that we have been discussing over the last 14 years with regard to the proper role of property taxes in support of communities and the state by in this case, businesses and seasonal rec. And I, in sitting there, have thought of another argument, actually, for your side, Mr. Chairman, in terms of separating seasonal rec from whatever we do with them, separating from the business property tax, and that is that the business property is still on the referendum market value and the seasonal rec is not, and that was pointed out to me. I've forgotten about that by Mr. Paulson. And so the comparison of treatment is actually the ag lands and seasonal rec, except the conundrum is that seasonal rec operates not like ag land, but like the commercial industrial. And so that's the horns of the argument, is that they're in between that. And the value, I can appreciate the values of the properties, seasonal rec properties in northern Minnesota in particular, have increased. Some of them are no longer seasonal rec. Some of them are homesteads, and my constituents have retired there and changed the property into their homesteads, and they do have a stake in the community, and they do get services, even though, like many of us, we don't have children in our own school district. So it remains in my mind a fascinating conversation that I'm not sure where we should go, except this is an opportunity to reduce a state tax that affects not just some businesses, but every single business in the state. My business is yours, and also the seasonal rec, but just putting that issue aside for further discussion. However, doing it in a very dramatic way, I'm fairly cautious about, and we'll hear from Senator Thompson later, but because the future is uncertain, and I and some others, including yourself, you know, we favor a huge reserve because we were here in the last decade facing very dramatic proposals for very dramatic cuts in the things that make the difference in Minnesota, and that's in how we treat our elderly in nursing homes in particular, and the care that they receive and the pay for their workers, and what we do for our children in our public schools. I don't want to face that again for as long as I'm in the legislature, and I hope to be here for a while longer. And so moving to dramatic decreases is quite frankly a scary proposition. My proposal doesn't do that. It's not cheap in the out biennium by any means, but I think it's a reasonable approach, and obviously, too, it's scalable. It could be a higher percentage per year. It could be, instead of getting to 5%, it could get to 10%. Maybe that's not too much. Maybe that's reasonable, but I'm a little bit leery of doing it all at one time. And I think Senator Jensen's made the arguments generally, and I really don't have anything further to say than that.
And Senator Rust, so in a nutshell, what Senate File 1557 is: elimination of the inflation, 5% reduction spread over 4 years.
That's correct.
Questions, members?
Pretty straightforward.
We have testifiers, Ms. Cadoon and Mr. Karleski. And Senator Rest, you know, I think that, you know, for the committee and for the public, I mean, we're going to try to make an effort to reduce property taxes for all Minnesotans,
yes,
including Minnesota businesses.
Yes.
We're just exploring the options that we have to get
for this for this area. I mean, we're also looking at a number of proposals that would decrease those jumps in property taxes on ag homesteads, mm-hmm, and also on just regular homesteads through the special property tax refund.
Ms. Cadoon.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Beth Cadoon. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'm also here representing the 73 local chambers of commerce and business associations around the state of Minnesota as part of the United for Jobs Coalition. We're here in strong support of all four bills that are actually reducing the business property taxes. I want to thank Senator Ress, Senator Thompson, Sachs-Hagen-Jensen for bringing these bills forward. You should have a handout with the United for Jobs Coalition. On the back lists all the business associations and local chamber of commerce that are part of this. And on the front lists some statistics regarding our business property tax. And I just want to highlight a few of those. A lot of these statistics are from the Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence. Does an excellent report that's nationally recognized on the 50 property tax study comparison. And what their study finds is, unfortunately, we have some of the highest taxes in the nation on our business property taxpayers. For example, we are second highest in the nation in rural Minnesota comparisons as compared to the other states. And what that really means when you break it down, when you say you're second highest in the nation, for example, of a $1 million property, we are 134% above the national average, and that's about $28,000 more in taxes that Minnesota businesses would pay in rural Minnesota versus in other rural areas of the country. On the market value for the metro area, we're about fifth highest in the nation on commercial properties. We rank a little better on the industrial properties, about 11th highest, and that's because of the personal property tax that's not taxed in Minnesota. So that is a benefit. So we're much higher, like I said, when you look at other states, and especially our bordering communities as well. But we're also much higher when you look at the other property taxpayers in Minnesota. We have about 12.4% of the market value, but we pay about 32% of the tax.
Wow.
A lot of that's due to our class rate, but it's also due to the statewide business property tax. Just that tax alone is about 30% of any business property tax in the state is the part that's paid to the state levy. So we like these bills that address this issue. We think we'll go a long way to help our competitiveness in this area. We hope as part of your budget or your bill that you're putting together, you can eliminate the increase that's occurring automatically with inflation. We also hope you can make some progress in reducing the actual levy amount. We think that would be very helpful. I'll turn it over to Steve Karolewski just to give some specifics on the examples of businesses that have to deal with these high property taxes. Thank you.
Mr.
Good morning, Chairman and Senators. I appreciate the time for me to come out here and speak with you this morning. I am a small business owner. I own a business in Golden Valley.
Could you please state your name?
My name is Steve Karolewski.
Thank you.
And don't let the East Coast accent fool you. I have been here 40 years. I'm a graduate of the University of Minnesota. We started our business 26 years ago, and we own an advertising agency. We specialize in the media portion of advertising, radio, TV, that kind of stuff. I have 17 full-time employees, and if you count in spouses and children, I represent about 41 people. In 2007, through the SBA, I'm a veteran. Through the SBA, I was able to get the SBA loan to buy a 4,600-square-foot building in Golden Valley. I paid $570,000 for that building at the time. It was top of market. My taxes at that time were $19,113. Now, I don't want to bore you all with a lot of numbers, but I think it's important that you understand where I come from as a small business owner, of trying to get some stability in my budgets. In 2008, my property taxes went down 7%. That was good. In 2009, they went up 6%. In 2010, they went up 5%. In 2011, they went down 17%. In 2012, they went up 28%. In 2013, I went up 4%. In 2014, I'm up 1%. And projected in 2015, I'm going down 5%. What this represents is you can pass all the laws you want, but the assessor's office comes back and says, we're just going to raise your property value or decrease your property value. That's how we're going to get the money out of you. So any legislation you have, I hope you're looking at that kind of stuff also. The point I really want to make today is that for 2015, my taxes for my 4,600-square-foot building will be $21,000. That means I have to generate $222,000, roughly speaking, in sales in order for me to pay my taxes. I don't have a sales force. I'm a guy that kills spiders in the ladies' room. I keep the water under the boat. I do my banking, and occasionally I go out and shake a few hands. We've grown our business through word of mouth and the quality of our work. But $222,000 on $1.2 million in revenue is a lot of money for me to generate. If I can pick up two new clients per year, I'm happy. Those clients represent about $100,000 in media. I'm happy. So for me to pay my $21,000, I got to generate $222,000 a year. So I hope that when you're on the floor and you're voting on these things, you remember that it's not about $50 million or $100 million or $1.3 billion. It's about Steve Karoluski and all the other small business people out there that have to generate large amounts of income to pay these taxes. I understand the value in the taxes. I get the police, I get the fire, I get the roads, I get all of that. But my house in Minnetonka is 3,000 square feet. My building in Golden Valley is 4,600 square feet, and I'm paying 300 to 400% more in taxes. So I'm hoping that you can think about me and the fact that I have to generate $222,000 just to pay $1,800 per month in property taxes. I thank you for your time.
And Mr. Karoluski, you brought up an issue with regard to valuation that this committee has paid particular attention to.
I'm glad to hear that.
We are working to try to bring more accreditation to the assessors of the state, trying to have more consistency across the state, because I think it is an issue.
I know a couple of guys in Jersey that might be able to help you there.
And so the property tax is interesting because it has two distinct components. One is the valuation and the other is the levy, and they are distinct. And we are trying to make the valuation part of it more accurate. The levy is a local unit.
Chairman, I find it really interesting. I belong to a three-unit condo, and I have the largest building of 4,600. The building next to me is about 3,800. Their taxes are 13,000. The building next to me is about 4,000 square feet. Their property tax is 20,000. I mean, there's just no consistency. That's the hard part for us. We contact the state. We hired an attorney. We tried to get our taxes reduced, and nothing happened. So I'm really glad that at least we're paying attention. You're talking about it now. Because it's not easy being a small business owner, as many of you folks in the room know. So I really thank you for your time and your consideration on this.
Thank you. Senator Gazelle.
Yeah, thank you. A comment and then a question for Ms. Cadoon, actually. But and the business owner can go online now and they can check all the properties around them. And if yours is lower than everybody else, you're thrilled. You're not going to rock the boat. But when yours is higher, then you're going, yeah, what's going on here? It's right. Not fair. But clarification for Ms. Cadoon. One of the comments was businesses have 12.4% of the total property market value but pay 32% of the total property tax. The business owners are the only ones that have that inflator. The rest of the property tax does not, if I understand this correctly, which means if we don't get rid of the inflator, that actually will just continue to be a bigger and bigger percentage of the pie. Is that correct?
Ms. Cadoon.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, well, the two who have the inflator are the seasonal rec properties as well as the business property taxpayers. They're the only ones that have the state levy. No one else does. But the difference between the seasonal rec and the business property taxpayers is we also pay the referendum levy for schools that is not paid by seasonal rec. So we actually pay all our local property taxes as well as the referendum, as well as the statewide levy, and no other property has all those three.
Yeah. So Mr. Chair, Ms. Cadoon, so then that would be a growing percentage if we don't get rid of the inflator.
Mr. Chair, exactly.
Ms. Cadoon. Well, Senator Gazelka, we don't know if it would be a growing, because as our economy grows, valuations grow. And I think if you look back over the last number of years that this has been in effect, it's actually been a declining percentage, not an increasing. And it varies year to year.
Yeah.
But we could get Mr. Paulson to get us some information on that, I would think.
And Mr. Senator Chair, my gut is that it will go up because we've been through a recession where business values also for buildings were down. And as the economy picks up, then those values tend to go up, you know, which means the numbers will go up.
Yeah.
At least that's been my experience.
Yeah, we'll get some data on that. Anything else for these witnesses? Senator S.
Mr. Chairman, I just do need to point out that one of the comments that have been that's made here about the effective tax rate of business property at being 3.88, where their class rate is 2.0. And just to remind ourselves that in the corporate income tax, it's just the opposite. But we only hear, for the most part, from the business community about what the nominal rate is. And we find ourselves having to remind the business community of what their effective rate is, which is much lower. But with regard to the property tax, it's just the opposite. So just to keep that in mind, that it flip-flops with regard to property tax and income tax, and behooves us to keep both of those in mind when we're talking about the property, about the tax burden of businesses in Minnesota.
Mr. Chair,
if I
can comment to that too, and you know, but I look at all business, but my lens is really towards the small business owner. And their income is typically going to be flow through, so they're not going to get that. You know, it's the business property tax, and then all the rest of their income is passed through, and it's on the income tax. So they're the ones that really, I think, get hit. Looking at this, they all get hit, but they particularly get hit.
Thank you.
There's two more testifiers, Senator Est, Mr. Champio, and Mr. Hickey. Welcome, Mr. Champion.
Yep. Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brandon Champo. I'm a commercial real estate developer with United Properties. We're a Minnesota-based development and investment company of commercial real estate properties. And I'm also representing NAOP, the Commercial Real Estate Development Association, which consists of pretty much the entire commercial real estate industry, but primarily the tenants that occupy commercial real estate businesses. I'm just going to tell you quickly here this morning how high property taxes affect our ability to get business done. My job is to build new buildings for new or expanding tenants in this state, and we rely 100% on business expansion. And for a tenant to expand, there's many factors that go into that that decision, but it typically starts with costs. And when a tenant is signing a lease in our building, there's three costs that they're focused on: rent, operating expenses, and taxes. We can control two of those, the rent and the operating expenses, and we control those by building efficient buildings and trying to keep the cost low. The property taxes we cannot control, and those are passed through directly to a tenant. We, as the building owner or landlord, don't pay the taxes. We get the tax bill, and it's immediately sent to the tenant, and then they pay for their share of the bill. We are trying to, when we sell our state to tenants outside of the state or to tenants in the state, we try to focus our sales pitch really on the qualitative factors of our state: quality of life, educated workforce. But those are becoming increasingly more difficult to pitch against when we're facing a top five or a top 10 ranking as one of the highest cost states. And so as tenants in our buildings get more sophisticated, which they have certainly done over the last few years, they hire consultants to really compare the cost of different states and to determine if it's cheaper to expand a building in Minnesota or in Denver or Seattle or Des Moines or wherever. And we're finding increasingly that if it is cheaper for them, oftentimes they will do that. So we try our hardest to focus on all the great things that our state has to sell, which certainly we do have plenty of great things to do or to sell, but an uncompetitive tax rate becomes increasingly more difficult. And so I appreciate the committee, you know, considering reduction of the property tax burden. I can promise you that it will certainly help businesses expand. It's not the only factor, obviously, but there's no business on earth that's looking for ways to increase costs. We're all trying to be more efficient. And when businesses in our state do expand, it's people like me as a developer that gets to build the building. It's the architect. It's the engineer. It's the construction workers, the lawyers, the bankers, everybody that's involved in our industry. We all benefit, and we would all thank you for making it easier for those tenants to expand.
Thank you, Mr. Ciampo. Mr. Hickey.
Mr. Chairman, Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. A lot of you are familiar with our group, but we have 13,000 members, and the majority do own commercial property and very impacted by the statewide commercial property tax. All these bills are very encouraging, and we're supportive of all of them. Senator Jensen's freezing it, Senator Rest reducing it and freezing it, and Senator Thompson has a more dramatic bill to phase it all out, which would be, I guess that's nirvana, Senator Thompson, if we ever get there, although this has been going on for 13 or 14 years now. But we do support this bill and appreciate Senator Rest bringing it forward. This is a real problem. It's 20% to 30% of a business's property taxes typically. And if you don't own the property, it's going to be passed through in your rents to the best the landlord can. This is still really a problem in this state, despite what we tried to do back in 01. As Beth Cadoon mentioned from the Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence, their recent analysis, second highest in rural commercial property with market values of 100,000 to a million. That's a lot of businesses. That's probably almost everything out there in your district. Rural members, fourth highest in the nation for $1 million industrial property, fifth highest in the nation for $1 million metro commercial property, a very common threshold of market value for medium-sized or hire small business in the metro area, and it's just really a problem still. And this would help a lot, and it would stop the statewide property tax from growing and reduce it to some degree, too. So we strongly support this bill and appreciate the attention you're paying to this today.
And Mr. Hickey and Mr. Ciampo, I think there's a note here that your testimony applies to all the bills that we're hearing, including Senator Thompson's. Any questions, members? Anyone? Another testifier.
Mr. Chair, Doug Carnival, McGranchet Carnival.
Mr. Carnival.
Representing the Greater Minneapolis Building Owners and Managers Association. These are the folks who own and operate the buildings in downtown Minneapolis and throughout Hennepin County. And we'd just like to echo the remarks that everyone has made. Kevin Lewis, the executive director, wanted to be here today but was out of town. And if he were here, he would tell you that it's not the buildings that pay these property taxes, it's the tenants, and many of whom are small businesses, many of whom you've heard from today. So we'd like to lend our support to all of these bills as well and thank the authors for bringing this forward.
Thank you, Mr. Carnival.
Thank you, sir.
Questions, members? Senator Sanjum.
Mr. Chair, just on the bill, and it's kind of technical. I almost hesitate to bring it up, but on the bill description that we have, Senator Rust, it talks about your goal of 5% over 4 years. And although that's the 5%, I don't see it in the bill itself. But if you just kind of do the computation, 5% less of $850 million is really about $807 million. And you have us ending at 818 million. Is that just
Chairman,
a computational
kind
of difference?
As I understand it, it's because it's a different base every year. Is that correct, Mr. Sylvian?
Ms. McQuay.
Mr. Chair and members, If you just take the forecasted amount, we have to consider inflation because inflation is forecasted as part of the state general levy. So if we start off with $854 million in taxes payable 15, and we stop it at that point and not inflate it anymore, and then we begin to take off 1.25% every year. You don't take it always off the 854, but you take it off the then in 4 years later you take it off the inflated amount
every year.
Okay. The nuances of taxes.
Senator Sanjum. Very good. Anyone else wish to testify on Senate File 1557? Seeing none, Chair will lay Senate File 1557 over for possible inclusion. Senator Thompson. Senator Thompson, getting to the crux of the matter.
All right. Mr. Chairman and members, thank you for this interesting discussion today. I've truly enjoyed it. I do want to make a little bit of a change to the bill. This came to me from a House member and contains two major provisions, one dealing with the general education aid and the other, of course, with the general levy. It really wasn't my intent to have the tax committee be the committee of original jurisdiction on section one of this bill, which deals with education. So, Mr. Sylvia, if you can explain, I believe, if I have this correct, Mr. Chairman, my request to the committee would be to essentially strip out section two to have heard here today, which deals with the general levy, but then go ahead and just refer 1722 as it pertains to education in section one over to the Education Committee without recommendation, if that pleases the chair and that makes sense. Mr. Sylvia, was that an accurate description?
Mr. Sylvia.
Mr. Chair and Senator Thompson, that's correct.
And so, members, we're going to take the statewide business portion of this and include it in our on our laid over bill. The rest of it will pass without recommendation to E-12 finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate
and
that.
What would be the motion, Mr. Sylvia? I don't know. We're going to find out. Senator Rest.
Well, if we did that, we want to take out the statewide business property tax.
Take it out.
Take that part out and send the bill on.
Send Senate File 1722 over.
Yeah.
Mr. Sylvia.
Mr. Chair, as Senator Thompson indicated, we can have the discussion about Section 2, which is the state general levy portion, but the motion would be to delete Section 2 of the bill and then that would just leave us with the provisions dealing with the education proposal, and then we would just either have a motion to refer without recommendation or to pass, and it would essentially just be Section 1 and 3 of the bill and send that on to the Committee on Education.
Okay. Senator Thompson, why don't we have our conversation on the bill, and then when we do the motion at the end, we'll delete Section 2, and I would prefer if we sent this without recommendation to E-12.
That's my desire. I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you. All right. Well, as we've all heard here today, there are all kinds of problems with the general levy as it pertains to tax policy. And we've heard discussions about recreational property. We've heard discussions about business property, et cetera. And so I guess my sense is we've got a tax here that is not performing particularly well from the perspective of people paying it, having to administer it, et cetera. So why not think about going a different direction, which is what this bill would do. It would phase the general levy out over a period of time. Now, there's been a great deal of focus on business here, but I would rather for just a moment talk about employees and families, because let's remember that when a quote-unquote business pays a tax, that's not necessarily where the tax incidence falls. Just because a corporation, an S-corp or a C-corp or an LLC or a sole proprietor writes a check for taxes, that does not mean that that is where the impact of that tax falls. This particular tax, I think, is especially insidious because it has a disproportionate harm on medium and small businesses. And although I live in the metro area, my town of Lakeville, you walk down the main street in what I kind of call older Lakeville, the part that's been around a while, And you see one small business after another, from the Ace Hardware Store to the Main Street Coffee Cafe to the Ben Franklin that's been there and owned by the same people since I moved to Lakeville in 1998. And this tax is hitting those people especially hard. And what happens is they then become unable to provide their goods or services at a lower price. They may have to employ less people, or they may have to employ people part-time that they would otherwise like to have their full-time. So while I'm certainly here hoping to spur business growth and development and commerce in this state, let's not forget that when the person that owns the Ace Hardware Store in Lakeville has less of a tax burden and is doing better, that individual might be able to employ my neighbor, and that's good for everybody. The second thing I want to point out about the general levy is you have to pay it regardless of your level of profitability. And so you have a startup business that most startups, unless they're very fortunate, will struggle for a year or two or three. And when you talk to entrepreneurs that start up a business and try a new venture, they typically have stories about not paying themselves for a period of time and maybe having to lay off an employee that's become a dear friend. And this tax doesn't account for a tough year in business. It is dependent upon the percentage of the payment relative to the value of the asset. And as I apologize, I can't recall which testifier it was earlier, pointed out the fact that this thing just hits you regardless of the condition of your business and can take you out of business and can cause you to have to lay off employees. It's bad for everybody, and it's not dependent on profitability. And the testifier further pointed out, just because you have an asset that is worth a lot of money, you might have a manufacturing plant that manufactures widgets that's huge by necessity because of the machinery you have and the number of people working. That doesn't mean you're profitable. But you know what? You get to pay that tax regardless of your profitability or lack thereof. This has been characterized, and probably fairly so, as somewhat of a bold proposal, and I know that it is. But I would point out that, and I agree with Senator Rest, by the way, economic circumstances can change. I don't think I'm mischaracterizing you to say just because we have a surplus forecasted today doesn't even mean we'll have one forecasted in November, let alone three or four Novembers from now. That being said, when we do have a roughly $1.87 billion surplus, and right now as we speak, the economic forecasts are pretty good. If we are unwilling to take this step now, when? We're certainly not going to do it if we're ever in a deficit situation. And then also, and my final comment, Mr. Chairman, in defense of doing this is, I understand that in the legislature we do static analysis and not dynamic. So in other words, we look at a reduction in revenue of 10% or 20% or 40% that's forecast from whatever it might be, the general levy repeal, and we say those are the numbers we're going to experience. But we know that life isn't static, and economics certainly isn't static. And I think that if we were to get rid of this tax and phase it out as this bill does, I'm not going into the specifics of the numbers, you can see them there, I think it would really boost economic activity, and the impact would not be as dramatic as we think. You know, like with income tax, we talk about the Laffer effect, that you can reduce income tax rates and you sometimes see an increase in tax revenue depending on elasticity and boring things like that economists talk about. And I've always said, if we could lay all the economists in the world end to end, that would be a good thing. So so Mr. Chairman and members, is it a bold step? Yes. Would we have to find ways to deal with it in terms of future budgets? Yes. But I think that just about everybody on this committee I've heard at one point or another make a comment indicating to me that there are significant problems with this tax. It's particularly harmful for businesses, especially medium and small businesses. I hail from East Grand Forks, a smaller town within the state, and those folks are hurt by this kind of thing. They're already struggling to compete with a more favorable tax and business climate across the river in North Dakota. And I just think the potential benefit from this outweighs the cost. And so, Mr. Chairman, I want to thank you for giving this bill a hearing, because I do know that it is bold, and your willingness to discuss this bill along with the other bills that have come up here, I think, is a good thing, and I appreciate it. So with that, members, I would happily stand for questions.
And Senator Thompson, we do have a testifier that wanted to testify, Mr. Adams, and so if he would want to come forward. Just briefly, I agree with a number of what you said, and I think that Senator Senjum's question about the policy of this statewide property tax, when property taxes are mostly supposed to be a local tax, is something worth contemplating in this conversation. But I also want to remember that if we were to do your proposal, would leave very little for property tax relief for all Minnesotans, and they struggle with the same issues about income and property taxes. If they're having a bad year, they have to pay the property tax on their house, irrespective of whether they lost their job or not. And so we kind of want to spread our relief broadly, but this certainly isn't, you know, something that we shouldn't be contemplating in the scheme of things. So any other questions for Senator Thompson first? Mr. Adams.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. Tim Adams, legislative representative from AFSCME Council 5. Thank you, Senator Thompson. Unfortunately, we're opposed to your bill. Since 2002, total property taxes on businesses in Minnesota has grown much less rapidly than taxes on homesteads, despite the fact that business taxable value has grown much more rapidly than homestead value. Since its inception, the state business property tax has insulated businesses from the effects of population growth and state aid reductions, and helped businesses enjoy a low rate of property tax growth relative to other classes of property. The phase-out of the state property tax, as opposed in Senate File 1722, will reduce state revenue by nearly $200 million in fiscal 2016-2017 and by nearly $800 million in fiscal 2018-2019. By the time the phase-out is complete in 2021, the biennial loss of revenue will be approximately $2 billion, greater than the surplus projected for the next biennium. By eliminating the state business property tax, the state increases the risk of structurally unbalanced budget for future biennia. Given the state property tax levy is currently shrinking from year to year in inflation-adjusted dollars per capita, there is no reason to cut this tax. Senate File 1722 is particularly harmful, greatly increases the risk of an unsustainable revenue reductions and a structurally unbalanced budget in future years. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Adams. Any questions, members? Anyone else wish to testify on Senate File 1722? Anything else, Senator Thompson?
Not from me, Mr. Chairman, just to make sure we make the motion correctly, but I've said all I want to say, and I appreciate the time.
Yeah, well, this will be part of our ongoing conversation here. Mr. Sylvia, we will move to delete Section 2, and then we will move Senate File 1722 without recommendation to the 12th Committee. Senator Thompson moves to delete Section 2. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Section 2 is deleted. Senator Thompson moves Senate File number 1722 be recommended pass without recommendation to Finance?
To Education.
To Education as amended. Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thompson, I just want you to know that I would have voted to pass it with recommendation.
All right.
Senator Thompson.
You know, sometimes you just don't. Sometimes you just don't ask enough in life.
So does it go to Finance? So this will be going to Finance, and they will refer it to the appropriate committee. Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, this is a technical question. Since the bill itself, the Senate file, is now moved to a different committee, how does the general levy portion stay in this committee? How does that work?
Senator Thompson, you will just make
my
a motion
agreement. By agreement.
By agreement, take it from the table.
Okay.
It's in the committee.
All right, very good. Thank you.
Anything else, members? Senator St. John.
Mr. Chair, and not on this bill, but just on a question I asked earlier, Ms. McQuay has an answer. I don't know if she wants to verbalize it or not. I suggested, because it was computational, that maybe put it on a sheet of paper and share it with us next time. But if she wants to give a verbal answer, the question was what percent of the $854 million, what percent of overall business taxes in Minnesota does that represent, business property taxes?
Ms. McQuay.
Mr. Chair and members, Senator Senjum, I do want to clarify the question a little further because of the clarification of what percent of business taxes. I do have, of the total levy, the state general levy does represent roughly 10%. Okay. When we're talking about business taxes, I'd probably have to do a little more research on what's considered a business tax. But of property taxes, it's considered roughly 10%.
10%. Thank you.
On the Senator Thompson motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Thank you, Senator Thompson. This bill is off to finance.
Thank you.
Senator Grzalka.
Thank you. I wanted all those bills to be laid over or moved on, because this would apply to all of them. But what do we know what the 2001 base number was for the statewide business property tax? We know now it's 800 plus million, but what was it in 2001?
588.
Senator,
I think it was 588.
No. Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, did we lay over those bills? Did you actually lay them over?
We laid the bills
over.
Okay. All right. Thank you. 588.
Thank you, Senator Thompson. Senator Marty. Senate File 1414.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I do have an A9, basically, I'd argue, technical amendment. You may want to put on, that would clarify what roles are handled in this bill by DNR versus Department of Revenue. And it also changes the classification for which payments are calculated on based from rural vacant land back to where it was in current law under managed forests. And Mr. Chair, that's what the fiscal note was run on, as if the amendment is in place. So I'd urge you to adopt that amendment.
Senator Marty's. This is not your first stop.
Right.
With this
That's
bill.
Why I was just trying to say I believe that's a technical amendment, and the fiscal note and everything was made to it. I mean, most of the amendment is changing Sustainable Forest Incentive Program to Sustainable Forest Incentive Act, and it's clarifying many times where the DNR would be running things instead of the Department of Revenue. And that was first of many conversations we had the issues Department of Revenue had. They don't want to be the ones who are administering the program. They want to send the payments but not run the program. I don't care. We can deal with it later. In other words, I don't think I don't think there's any disagreement over it. But as you point out, this is not the first committee, so I don't want to classify it as an author's amendment. But I think it is the direction that the.
And Senator Marty, maybe a question for Mr. Sylvia. Did I hear you say that you are changing the base that the formula calculation is going to be on from rural vacant land to managed forest land? And, Mr. Sylvia, where in the amendment is that? I'm not seeing it.
Mr. Chair and members, on line 1.5 of the amendment, we are deleting Section 8. Section 8 was the change from Class 2 C to rural vacant land. We're going back to the way it currently is, so we're deleting the whole section.
Oh, okay. Any other questions, members? Seeing none, all those in favor of the Marty A9 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. A9 is adopted. Senator Marty.
And Mr. Chair, before going into the bill, I'll just also clarify, we've met with Department of Revenue. They have some more technical, they had a number of technical changes in Senate Council and Research, and your staff are working on them, but I would describe them as basically technical things for the workability of the bill with the Department of Revenue. But
But with that, I'll go and explain briefly. The Sustainable Forest Incentive Act was, I think it's 2001, was created to encourage private forest landowners in the state to adopt and use sustainable forest management practices. And we've had incentive payments based on that is an incentive to get private landowners to do that. They're currently set at $7 an acre and a minimum 8-year covenant that they agree to. And the legislative auditor issued a report in November 2013 on the program in which they found a lot of things needed to be improved in terms of accountability and so on. And then after that report, I know Senator Saxhog and the Forest Resource Council, DNR, and other stakeholders came together. How can we respond to that? And this bill is largely, it's trying to adopt the recommendations of the legislative auditor's report to make the program more useful, more functional, help it accomplish the goals it wanted. And then on top of that, I want to thank the chair and the tax committee staff for helping with a very, I think, very creative and thoughtful change in terms of how we provide incentives in setting up three different stages where you can set aside land for 8 years, you can set aside land for 20 years, or even for 50 years, and in exchange for taking a longer covenant, you are getting a larger payment. In effect, I think, and I don't know if you have the fiscal note, but in effect what it would mean if you have land that you're going to commit for 50 years, you'd get, I think it's based on 100% of the average tax rate for managed forest land. It would be a payment of estimated to be $13.08 an acre. If you only commit to a 20-year one, which is much more common type of thing in other areas, you get 75% of that, or just under $10. If you did it for 8 years, it would be about $7. We're still trying to figure out right percentage that would be appropriate for that. And if you have a conservation easement, you could only do an 8-year one, but you'd get 25% or three-some dollars out of it. And in effect, what we're trying to do is encourage landowners to keep this land committed for a longer period of time. And for a long time, Minnesota has, I think, roughly half of our forestry lands are privately owned, a lot of it by large forest industry companies. And because of some of the previous changes in the tax law, they started selling off a lot of their lands, parceling it out. And this is designed to keep forest land in forestry, to help long-term for environmental, for states, for our state traditions, to keep things in the way they were longer-term. And I really appreciate the, I think, creative approach that the tax committee chair and staff had suggested in terms of trying to give a bigger incentive for people who are going to do this for a longer period of time. I'm going to turn it over to Dave Zemeta from the Forest Resources Council, who was heavily involved in the responding to the legislative auditor's report. And with that, I'll turn it over to him unless there are questions.
Any questions for Senator Marty? And the only thing I would add is I think that they had a little difficulty trying to anticipate what level of time period people might sign up for. So there's a little question on the fiscal note there, but it's you know, it's kind of uncertain, but it's around $3 million now.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rester.
You mean that the question involves anticipation of taxpayer behavior, so it's a dynamic scoring issue that is has an impact here, but they really can't do that, so it's just really a guess. Is that, am I getting?
Senator Rest, I think they actually tried to talk to some of the landowners, but if they sign up for 50 years, the cost is more, and they don't know exactly what people are going to do.
So they just made some guesses about how many, as opposed to, which is a little bit like dynamic scoring.
A little bit.
Okay.
Mr. Zemeta.
Senator Skoy, members, my name is David Zemeta. I serve as Executive Director of the Minnesota Forest Resources Council, which is a state forestry council created by the legislature in 1995 to advise the governor, the legislature, and public agencies on sustainable forest policies and practices. I'll be speaking to you today on behalf of both Dr. Calder Hibbert and my staff, myself, and the Forest Resources Council. Just for the sake of time, consolidate the testimony here. Minnesota has over 17 million acres of forest land, over half of which is privately owned. These lands provide the state with timber supply, jobs and other forest products, hunting and other recreational activities, wildlife habitat, protection of water quality, to name just a few of the benefits. The Sustainable Forest Incentive Act, or SFIA, as I'll be referring it to it from here on out, was created to encourage sustainable forest management and produce public benefits flowing from these private lands. 2013, as Senator Marty mentioned, the legislative auditor released a report that was critical of the SFIA program, developed a number of recommendations to address the program's shortcomings. In turn, Senator Saxhog and Representative Dill asked the commissioners of Revenue, DNR, and the Forest Resources Council to form a stakeholder group to respond to the auditor's report. We co-convened a stakeholder group that met a number of times over the past year, a very diverse array of interests, and that group developed a set of recommendations that was very much in agreement with the auditor's recommendations, and delivered those combined recommendations back in January to Senator Saxhog, to Representative Dill. Those, through the hard work of a number of different interests, Minnesota Forest Industries, Minnesota Forestry Association, the DNR, an array of other folks here at the legislature, as Senator Marty mentioned, and others, put together Senate File 1414 that you have in front of you, and the companion bill, House File 1410, which in the House. That address recommendations both from the legislative auditor's report and the stakeholder group. The bills aren't exactly the same. This one addresses some additional recommendations from the auditor's report that House File 1410 doesn't address, and there are differing views on that that you'll hear in the testimony later. The recommendations in Senate File 1414 include requiring a forest plan by the DNR, an annual certification and management report, moving various administrative tasks from the Department of Revenue Commissioner to the DNR Commissioner, clarification of ownership transfer practices, and increased penalties. And all of these are very important recommendations that certainly we agreed with and the stakeholder, by and large, agreed with. Last week, the Minnesota Forest Resources Council, really at Senator Scoy's request to me, passed a resolution by a vote of 12-0, which you will see in your packet, that supports passage of legislation by the 2015 Minnesota Legislature to improve the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act and program by addressing the recommendations from the Office of the Legislative Auditor and the SFIA stakeholder group. The council members had this bill that you have in front of you, Senate File 1414, last week, that they had reviewed and were supportive of that. I want to emphasize that the Minnesota DNR is a member of the Forest Resources Council but was not able to vote on the resolution because Forrest Bow, the DNR member of the council, was not present, and his alternate, who was present under council protocols, can't vote. And I'll let Mr. Bow speak for himself. He'll be testifying in a little bit, so you'll hear what the DNR's view is on this. Also, the Minnesota Department of Revenue, not a member of the council. Mr. Cummings, representing Department of Revenue, will be speaking for the Department of Revenue a little later. So and the 12-0 vote doesn't represent the Department of Revenue either. So with that, I will conclude my testimony. Be happy to answer any questions.
And Senator Marty, I see both DOR and DNR are here. I don't know if DNR wants to say anything or not, but maybe we'll bring the agencies up and hear from them. Mr. Bow and Ms. Fish? Ms. Fish.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Andrea Fish. I'm here with the Department of Revenue Property Tax Division. I supervise the staff that administers the Sustainable Forest Program. So thank you, Senator Marty, for allowing me to be here today. Paul Cummings is at the House, and he asked me to speak on his behalf. So as the current administrator of this program, we do have a good working knowledge of the program, and as it moves forward, we look forward to working with you, Mr. Chair, and other members of the committee, as well as Senator Marty, on this bill. And we thank you for your openness as we've worked through the different technical issues that we've brought up. I also do want to note that there are other technical housekeeping items related to SFIA within the department's technical bill. We do believe that those items are needed to ensure the program continues to be administered in a consistent way, regardless of which department is administering the program. So thank you for the opportunity to testify. We're here if you have any questions.
And Ms. Fish, the items in the technical bill that will be heard tomorrow, are they consistent with the proposal of Senator Marty's?
Senator Skoid, they are related specifically to the types of properties that could enter into the Sustainable Forest Program as it has been administered. So they're not in conflict with this bill by any means.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Bowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, for the record, my name is Forrest Bowe. I'm the Director of Forestry with Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. First of all, I'd like to thank the authors and the other groups that have been working on this bill, working to clarify the goals of the SFIA program. Because SFIA matters. SFIA keeps forests as forests. It maintains private forest lands and slows fragmentation. It protects clean water by keeping more forest land on the landscape. And it provides wildlife habitat, recreation opportunities, and options for landowners. And it also provides forest products for our forest industries, which means jobs for our communities. So the SFIA program is important, and we appreciate the clarification that's happening in this bill. With regard to the amendment, I believe we have identified the appropriate roles for both the Department of Natural Resources and the Department of Revenue. So we certainly support the bill and support the roles that are clarified there. And I can stand for questions.
And Mr. Bowe, I think that the Department of Natural Resources is going to have a much more involved role. You'll be doing a lot of the oversight. So at some point, I'd like to have a conversation with the department about what your expectation is with regard to administrative costs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I look forward to that. I did notice in the current fiscal note, it talks about just the program itself rather than administering the program. So we'd certainly like to weigh in on that.
Not that I'm asking for it, but I expect you guys will be coming along, and I'd like to do it sooner rather than later. Any questions, members?
It's a good program.
Thank you. Mr. Brandt.
Thank you very much. Mr. Wayne Brandt, Minnesota Forest Industries. Our members are primary manufacturer of forest products, paper mills, sawmills, engineered wood products manufacturers, large forest landowners, and other forest products companies. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. We think that Senate File 1414 is a significant step forward, makes significant improvements to SFIA. We think it heads in the direction of being a significantly better program that will accrue more benefits to the environment and the public. I think just a brief historical note, SFIA replaced the previous law in this area, which was the tree growth tax law. There have been auxiliary forest tax laws and provisions. I think there's four auxiliary forest contracts still out there waiting to be concluded. And there have been various both tax and other programs throughout the course of the history of our state. In fact, encouraging the growing of trees is also included in our state constitution. So it's not a new issue for the state or for the tax committee. The bill does a number of things. I mean, we're very interested in the tier concept that was put in of different years of commitments for different amounts of payments. So we like that concept. We're not sure that 8, 20, and 50 is perfect, as the chairman mentioned earlier. So we want to continue to work with the committee and staff on that. We support having a formula. SFI originally had a formula that was changed to a fixed payment. You know, we think a formula better reflects the changes going forward and the factors on which the payment is based. You know, we want to be clear that there needs to be, in our view, an out clause from the covenant if the payments are significantly altered at some point. This happened in 2009, 2010, when payments were first unallotted and capped, and then capped by legislative action. So that significantly changed the program, particularly for the larger landowners that I represent, and it ended up in litigation. And we have a different view of what that litigation meant than the Department of Revenue does. Our view of it is that the court essentially said that this program is subject to biennial appropriations, which in our view, even with an 8, 20, 50-year commitment on our part, if the payment isn't there, there's, you know, we'd like to be able to get out of a covenant. One thing that I would like to highlight is there's an area in this program that's an incredible deal for the citizens, and that is the public access that's provided by the larger landowners. In the current program, at $7 an acre, all of those lands holdings that are greater than 1,920 acres have to provide public access. If you look at actual transactions and also research done by the University of Minnesota, that access is worth from $11 to $50 per acre per year. So we're getting that access for $7, as well as all of the environmental benefits and the restrictions on parcelization that others meant. I guess the final thing that I'd like to highlight is you know, this legislation is responsive to the legislative auditor's report from 15 or 16 months ago. We think that's important. The legislative auditor reviewed this program in some depth. We think they spent a lot of time trying to understand it in both breadth and depth, and that the recommendations from that report provide important guidance. This legislation responds to those recommendations, and we support that. So we look forward to continuing to work with the committee, with staff, with the author on this issue as we move forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brett. Questions? Anyone else wish to testify on Senate File 1414?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Bruce Zumballen, Chair of the Government Relations Committee for the Minnesota Forestry Association. I'm speaking on behalf of the 2,300 small landowners that are enrolled in the SFIA. Our mission as an organization is to encourage the retention and sustainable management of family-owned woodlands, many of which are often under pressure for development, and where many owners lack the knowledge of woodland management. We strongly support this bill from the standpoint of the key recommendations of the legislative auditors. Frankly, we tried to address those very same issues in the 2011 legislative session with Senate File 842. So we think this bill goes a long way towards helping to continue to keep these private forest lands as forest. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee. Thank you, Senator Marty, for the opportunity to speak on this bill. My name is Stephen Baker. I'm the Ramsey County Assessor, and I'm appearing today as a member of the Legislative Committee for Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. Our MAO members have asked me to speak. You know, true disclosure, I don't have any SFIA properties in Ramsey County. But our members that are concerned about this were too far away to make it to the hearing today, so they've asked me to speak for them. Our association and our members support the updating of the program. We think it's, you know, a natural reaction to the reports and the analysis that's been done in the past. We're very pleased that this Senator Marty's bill is keeping this a state-administered program. Some of our members are concerned that the responsibility to administer this program could come back to the counties eventually, and so we're very pleased with that. I think some of the changes in the A9 amendment, specifically having the Department of Revenue be responsible for the payments, probably will relieve some of the concern of our members. And we thank you for the language providing for annual notification of plan information to local assessors. We think that should help us with some of the interactions. There's value interactions that can come from these programs. I don't yet know what a 50-year an agreement might do to valuations. I think we'll have to see where that heads. But the more that local assessors know about the properties that are enrolled in these kinds of programs, the better that they can treat them uniformly, like some of the conversations we've had earlier today, the need for uniform valuation. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. Any questions, members? Seeing none, thank you. Anything else, Senator Marty?
Mr. Chair, just want to say that I really appreciate both the Response and Forest Resource Council and Senator Saxhog and others in pulling that together to respond to the auditor's report, and I also equally much appreciate the creative idea that you and your staff had come up with on how to lock in longer contracts, covenants with people. I think this is what we're trying to do. It reverses what, well, we hope it reverses what happened in recent years when, because of tax policy and so on, we encouraged the breakup of large tracts of forest land. And I think this does serve the public very well and our environment and our resource opportunities for people very well. So I'm excited about it, and I hope as we go forward, again, Ms. Fish didn't mention it, but we still have to work more on some details to make it administratively workable well. But I think those are technical in nature, and I'm excited about it.
Thank you, Senator Marty. I really appreciate your work on this important issue. Seeing nothing else, Chair will lay Senate File 1414 over for possible inclusion as amended. Thank you, Senator Marty. Tomorrow, 8:30 for the full committee, policy and technical bills and members' dependent care bills. Nothing on Friday. Anything else, Senator? Nope. Seeing nothing else, the committee is adjourned.